So I wanted to bring the class this afternoon inside because we want to talk about the tattva. Tattva means the philosophical principles behind something. So being outside near Giriraj was full of so much spontaneous sweetness. It's difficult to want to speak about the inner structure of what we're examining, because the outer feature is so beautiful that one doesn't feel any need to. But actually, the more that we know about a particular subject, the more carefully we understand it, then the deeper that we can enter into the transcendental natural beauty of the Dharma. So when I was thinking where to start, so tomorrow of course we'll go on Prikram and then we'll just go. So whatever you learn today will be helpful for you tomorrow. But we'll forget about all the philosophy tomorrow and we'll simply go and try to relish or to taste the different transcendental flavors of the sweet pastime places around Govardhan. So when I was thinking where to start, this picture came into my mind. Unfortunately, it would be nice if we had a chart, but we don't. We have only this. But everybody must be familiar with this picture, because this picture Srila Prabhupada himself composed and designed for the cover of his Srimad Bhagavatam when he was printing in Delhi before he came to the United States. And when he came, the first canto, the very original first cantos, all had this particular picture on it. So it was interesting because I myself hadn't thought of this picture probably in 30 years. It never entered into my head, and all of a sudden I thought, I have to get this picture and I have to show this to you. Because this gives us, even though it's a crude, you know, on the back cover, and you'll have to apologize that it's small, but it gives us a little bit of an idea, an insight into what is taking place. Now Srila Prabhupada wrote on the inside cover about this particular drawing that he conceived of. And he explained that, first of all, primarily number one, he put little numbers on the inside cover and a small explanation of this picture. And the first thing he explains is number one, this here, the lotus frilled large area in the main place, this is Krishna's Goloka Dham, Goloka Vrindavan. Up here, where Radha and Krishna are existing and enjoying transcendentally, totally beyond the material world, entirely beyond the material world. Then secondarily, he points out that this, as you can see, there's some glowing coming from this transcendental Goloka Dham. And he explains that that glowing is the original planet of Goloka, throwing off a spiritual ray of effulgence called the Brahma Jyoti, which is the ultimate goal of the impersonalists. So you can locate everything here. So this glowing effulgence is what the many people, most people who have any spiritual conceptions throughout the world of any validity or any clarity, they're seeking for some kind of an experience relating to this glowing effulgence. Then thirdly, he explains that there are innumerable planets within the spiritual dimension. And these planets are presided over, each one by a predominating personality. And each one, he explains, you can say that they're all the same. It's all really Krishna in so many manifestations. They're all the same, but they're simultaneously different and individual. And the living entities within the spiritual world, they exist within one of these transcendental abodes where they're perfectly happy to be. It's their natural place within the spiritual world. Then he shows here a small area. You can see how small that is in comparison. A very small area here, and there's a lot going on inside that. And this area here is the Mahatattva. This is a small area of the spiritual sky, the whole spiritual dimension, becomes covered, you could say, by a small black cloud. And then within that area, so much description is given, the river Viraja is there surrounding this area to make it distinct from the rest. But it's non-different than this, but it's become covered. And within that area, Mahavishnu, he lies down. And when Mahavishnu lies down in seed form, innumerable universes come from his breathing. As he breathes out, they come into existence. This is his size and dimension. It was inconceivable. When he breathes in, they are all again unmanifest. They're not visible. They still remain, but they remain in a potential form within the form of Mahavishnu. And then from him comes one of these universes. Then Garbhadakshay Vishnu lies down. And then from his navel comes a lotus. And from that lotus, Lord Brahma is born within that universe. And then existence, the secondary creation within that one tiny universe, one of millions, in this tiny little section, small compared to all the vast spiritual area, in that situation, this is where the conditioned souls find themselves placed. Can you fix the seems just that it's gone, the power's gone. So then the reason I want you to see this is because it's really important to understand how everything relates to each other. Because if we understand how everything is related to each other, we can understand our position in relationship to the transcendental Dham. And we can understand the unnaturalness of our present situation, which we, from the perspective of conditioned souls living in the world, living in some country, some land, with some family, consider perfectly natural and normal. But actually, when we see this scope, we can understand something. So, Srila Prabhupada, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the third chapter, he explains something about this. Third verse, I beg your pardon, of the first chapter. He explains that, he starts to explain about what is rasa, because we'll hear this word so many times, rasa. So he explains that rasa actually means the particular type of relationship that the living entity has with Krishna himself. He explains how there are 12 rasas, technically. Every living being, beginning from Brahma, the firstborn within the material world, down to the insignificant ant, desires to relish some sort of taste derived from sense perception. That means that includes all of us also. We are seeking some taste. These sensual pleasures are technically called rasas. Such rasas are of different varieties. In the revealed scriptures, the following 12 varieties of rasas are enumerated. Then Srila Prabhupada goes through, starting from some of the secondary rasas, such as anger. This is actually a taste. It's there within the spiritual realm. It's here. People become angry. People think, I shouldn't become angry, but they become angry all the time. Because anger is a particular rasa. Wonder or shock or amazement is a rasa or a taste, both here and within the spiritual realm. Conjugal love, comedy, chivalry. So if you think, anybody is thinking of some drama, some movie, some situation in life, you'll see that it goes not beyond any of these 12. Everything is composed of these 12 rasas. The next one is doya, or mercy. Then comes dasya, or servitorship. Then sakya, or friendship. Then bhayanaka, or horror, ghastliness. This is a rasa. You see people, they go to horror movies, and they get a taste from this. Why do they get a taste from this? Why do they watch these things? Is this some kind of a perversion of something? No, this is a rasa. So then, after that, bibhatsata, or shock. Shock is a rasa. You know, I remember when I was young, we would go to the fun fair type of things, and you go on these rides, and you go up like this, and down like that, and up like this, and your stomach goes up, and your stomach goes down, and you come going down and up and down, and people take this, what's that called, where they they tie that string to their foot and then they jump. Yes. So you can just think, what are they doing? Why do people are drawn to these things? Why are they drawn to these things? We say, oh, that's all Maya. But this is also a rasa. So shock, then shanta or neutrality, indifference, and finally vatsalya or parenthood. These 12 rasas exist within all of eternality. They exist within the whole of the spiritual and also therefore the material world. The only difference between this large area and this small area here is the object. The object of satisfaction, the object of these rasas, what one is actually, who one is absorbing oneself in. So we'll continue. This morning we were listening to that lecture from Srila Prabhupada, and he was talking about how actually the conditioned soul is never fallen. We never actually fall. And any of us who have any kind of introspection about our own helpless, seemingly fallen condition, sort of marvel at the thought that we haven't fallen, because we feel extraordinarily as if we have. But he was explaining that it's like a play. And in that play, someone is playing a particular role. In order to play that role, they have to feel the part. It's all based on feeling. So, therefore, when we come here, we assume a particular role and a particular identity, and it is given to us the feelings that go along with that particular part. So the question would come then into one's mind, why would we come here? What would be the reason why we would want to come here and play a particular role if it is not actually really us? Does anyone remember what Srila Prabhupada's comment was in that regard? Why do we come here to do this? Because we want to imitate Krishna. And what is Krishna?
The enjoyer.
We want to come here to enjoy. So then, because we have this difficulty, that we have this enjoyment spirit at this particular time, it's very difficult for us to enter deeply into the Dhamma. Because the primary principle is different there. The central enjoyer is Krishna. And here, everyone, as Srila Prabhupada describes, they're like little tiny circles or nucleuses with ourselves in the center. And everyone is going like that. And as you can see, there's so much clashing. On a personal level, there'll be so many clashes. On a country level, there'll be so many clashes. On an international level, there'll be so many clashes and conflicts. And he also points out that here, everything is limited. Whereas there, everything is unlimited. We're familiar with the fact that here, things are limited. We can see that by the fact that if we keep trying to invite people to come and sit in this room, before we know it, there'll be no more space for anyone to sit. So we think in these terms of limitations, and when we think of the Dhamma, we also carry these concepts, misconceptions with us. Now, I'd like to, if you don't mind, if you can be a little bit patient, I'd like to summarize something that I read one time. It was written by Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and is very, very powerful. But I'm not quite sure whether I'll be able to convey the full power of his meaning in a summary form. But he explains about the dilemma that the living entity comes into when he chooses to come to the material world. He begins by explaining that the soul, the jiva, is the embodiment of pure consciousness. This is what a person is, a living entity is. And that he cannot function properly within this universe. And the reason he cannot function properly is because he's dislocated from his proper plane. And because of that, he's banished from truth and happiness. He cannot achieve these here. He goes on to explain that this misery is due to mistaking oneself for one's body and mind, which are part of this world, and that are therefore under the control of nature. They have to obey the laws of nature here. And that the soul tries to rebel against nature by using nature's laws to dominate nature. And we see this so much. In India, you see it a lot less because the attempt is usually a little clumsier. But any Western country, you can see how busy they are to take the laws of nature and use them to control nature, to adjust things. When it's too hot, they know how to make it just the right temperature for enjoyment. When it's too cold, they can adjust that also. When anything that goes the way they don't like, they've worked out some way to work against nature. And there's a natural spoken or unspoken sense that nature's not so ideal. So we have to fix it up a bit. We have to make things work a little bit better than they work in their ordinary state. So the living entity, because he is self-forgotten, he's forgotten who he really is, and he's trying to do this. He's thinking that he is his body and mind, trying to enjoy nature. He thinks that he will be happy if he gets what he thinks will make him happy. And he finds himself unhappy when he doesn't get what he thinks will make him happy. But actually, the growth and decay and the destruction of the body and mind all take place in relationship to higher laws, and he has no control over these laws. So the soul himself, the cosmic control, the control of over the mind and body, has no control over the soul proper. But because he identifies himself with the mind and the body, he finds himself feeling that he's under the control of the material nature. The soul proper is subject only to the spiritual powers of the divinity. And if he chooses, he can function in his own position in the spiritual system and become constitutionally free. But when he chooses not to serve the absolute, he loses this natural state of free control, freedom, and he's forced to submit to divine will under pressure. So Maya makes a world in which Godhead remains invisible. This is done for the benefit of the jiva. So this is made, a world is made where Godhead remains invisible. Why? So that he is free to be able to go on with his atheistic and materialistic activities, which only result in ever-increasing misery. So then Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati goes to this situation. Why do we want this? Why are we in this position? And when I was reading this, sometimes when I read this article, it just confuses me and I get annoyed and I put it away. And I can't follow his logic because it's too subtle and fine. And other times when I'm in a more urgent, thoughtful mood and I read it, it's so subtle but so clear what our problem is. So I'll see again if I can explain this. He explains that the living entity, the jiva, he wants to be the master. So we can say that. Yes, of course, we see that. We want to be the master. But he explains that he isn't the master. He can never be the master. So I was thinking of an analogy. It's like if a child says, I want to be my mother. You can say, I want to be a mother. But the child says, I want to be my mother. I want to be my mother. And the mother says, you can't be me. I'm me. You're you. You're the child. That's who you are. No, no, no. I want to be my mother. You can't be your mother. It's an impossibility. You can't actually take that role because by very nature you can't be that. And this is what the living entity can't accept. He doesn't want to accept. I can't be God. I'm sure I can be God. If I just try a little harder, I can enjoy here. It will work out for me. But actually, by definition, he cannot. He explains. He wants to be the master. He wants to be God, but he cannot be God. So if he wants to be other than what he is, which is a jiva, then the only option is that he can be nothing. So rather than him being nothing, which is basically to destroy himself, so Godhead makes an arrangement so he can feel as if he can be the master. He offers this to him in lieu of his service. He says, you want to be the master, but actually you're a jiva, and you can be nothing other than a jiva. So Godhead says, all right, I'll maintain you in such a way that you can think that you're not being maintained. You're self-maintained. I'm maintaining myself. I'm God. I can take care of myself. And how many times you talk to people, again, particularly in the West, and they say, I don't believe in God. And they say it with such sort of like blaseness that they really, as if they have this massive choice to believe in God or not. It's a minor thing. I don't believe in God. And they go on with their lives. The depth of their ignorance is so vast. They have no understanding whatsoever. And in that ignorance, they're thinking, I'm actually quite happy. But there's always a contradiction. So he says, Godhead maintains the jiva who wants to be God. Because if he didn't maintain him, he would cease to be. So he allows him to imagine that he's self-maintained, whereas actually he is completely unable to maintain himself without God. He does not want to be ruled by his master. Listen to this one. This one really struck me when I read it. He wants to pursue an independent course with the help of the powers of Godhead. Do you see a contradiction? He wants to be independent with the help of the powers of Godhead. So this is the dilemma. I want to be independent, but I need the sun, I need the land, I need to build a house, I need a family, I need something. I want to be independent. This independence is so deep in the living entity. But Godhead's powers can never become subordinate because they're his powers. They cannot subordinate to the living entity. So when he wants to pursue his independent course with the help of the powers of Godhead, the only way that it can work is if Godhead produces the illusion in the fallen soul that he's being served while he is actually being really dominated. At every moment he's being dominated and he thinks, I'm being served. And then Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur finished with this sentence that always struck me ever since I read it first. He said, this is the untruth that is necessary for the existence of a jiva in defiance of Godhead. So this is our position. Practically speaking, this is our position. We've come here to the material world, to that minute, complicated, dark situation here, leaving behind in whatever way we have, whatever way Godhead has arranged for us, but not interested in this part, not interested in this part, but interested in pursuing our independence in that part. So many arrangements he makes for the living entity. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains that he even goes with him within the heart. This is a kind of leela. He explains, this is the Lord's leela within matter. Sometimes we hear people say, if an impersonalist, and you say to them, you're here in this material world, how can you be God? And he says, this is my leela. And we criticize very hotly this fallacy that God can become bewildered. It's true, he does not become bewildered, but he goes with each and every bewildered soul and waits with him. Just as the analogy of two birds within the one tree, waiting side by side on the same branch, he waits with him until the living entity becomes willing to deal with his problem, to deal with the issue that's the core issue of his whole existence. And that is his defiant attitude towards Godhead. So one time I remember Srila Prabhupada was asked by Satsarup Maharaj in a very kind of a humble mood. He said, why is it that it's so difficult to become free of Maya? Why is it so difficult to serve Krishna? Why can't we just give up Maya and serve Krishna? And Srila Prabhupada looked at him and said, because you hate him. And Satsrup Maharaj, when he told this story, he said, I was shocked. He said, I thought at least he could find a word that was not so harsh. He said, I certainly don't feel like I hate him. And Srila Prabhupada remained grave. And he called for Bhagavad Gita, as was his habit. And he had him look up this verse, Icha Dvesha Samutena. And he explained, he had him read this verse. And in this verse, of course, Krishna is saying that all living entities are born into delusion, overcome by the dualities of desire and hatred. So this was very, Satsrup Maharaj commented, this was very shocking to him, the thought that our problem is so deep. I think, you know, I'm a bit apathetic, or I'm a bit dull sometimes, or sometimes it's hard for me to remember, but we don't recognize this very deep dilemma that the living entity possesses, which is that he actually hates God. He wants to be here. He wants to be independent of his master. So now we come to the next point, which is the nature of the Dham. So I would like to ask you, can anybody give me some English equivalents of what they would describe when we say the Dham? What do we mean? Anyone can give us an English term? Yes. Holy abode. Holy abode. Yes. Transcendental abode. Spiritual world. Any other descriptions?
Holy land.
Holy land. Any
spiritual
more?
Shelter.
Spiritual shelter. Where Krishna is the center? Yes. A sacred place? Any more? These are all correct. Yes.
A place where Krishna is pleased.
Yes, that's a very nice one. A place where Krishna is pleased. I will read any others? Yes, Brahma.
Bridge to spiritual realm. Like a bridge to spiritual realm.
A bridge to the spiritual realm. That's an interesting one. We'll talk about that. Thank you. An embassy? That's also an interesting one. Because the bridge to the spiritual realm and embassy, where they come in within the concept of achintya veda abheda tattva. Because the Dham, which we'll speak about later, is like that. It is the spiritual realm, but it also provides a bridge between the material and spiritual. So I've written a few here. You can see if we've added any more than what we've already spoken. The Dham, spiritual abode, kingdom of God, beyond Maya's power, a transcendental place, the prime support and nurturer, the residence of God, the home and the goal of all. It's identical to the Lord, completely, to the Lord's completely spiritual nature. And all forms, reflections of activities there are all expansions of Godhead, inseparable parts. Everything there exists for the unrestricted pleasure and happiness of God. The Lord's realm and the Lord himself are identical. The holy Dham is seen not by argument and logic. It can only be seen through natural samadhi or spiritual trance. And Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu reveals the deepest confidential secrets of the holy Dham. He reveals the special glory of the transcendental sentiments of Mahabhav, the sentiments of Srimati Radharani. So the Dham is identical with Krishna. And although the living entities retain their individuality within the Dham, they are all identical with Krishna. They're expansions of Krishna. And the intimate role of Krishna's Dham is that it renders direct service to Krishna. Everyone there renders also direct service to Krishna. So then, Oh yes, this is the last one that I had. This is like Narayani's. That the Dharma exists to make many wonderful arrangements to satisfy the Lord's desires. This is why the Dharma is there. So then the question may arise, does that mean that everything that we see when we're standing here by Giriraj, looking towards the Dharamshala, looking down the road, left and right, up and down, does that mean that everything that we're looking at is completely this transcendental Dharma? So then, we have to understand also from here that there are different aspects of the Dharma. This is also very important for those who want to comprehend very carefully and refinedly what is transcendental and what is not transcendental in what we're viewing with our eyes. So the Dharma has three different aspects. One is the prakat. When the Dharma is in the prakat form, it means, when prakat means manifest, it means when Krishna's pastimes are taking place here. And when Krishna's pastimes take place, prior to Krishna's appearance, or prior to the appearance of even Lord Nrisingadev, when he appeared so suddenly from a pillar, prior from the appearance of Godhead, the Dharma appears. And this is something that's super mundane. It's beyond, it's not like a spaceship that goes ooh, and it lands and then the Lord appears. But this is a transcendental appearance of the Lord's Dharma. And the Dharma, as we heard, was a place where everything is for the Lord's pleasure. Everybody, everything is an expansion of Krishna himself to give him pleasure and satisfaction in loving exchanges with his devotees. So when the Dharma appears, it touches, you could say, so to speak, a particular place in a particular universe. And from there, then the pastimes continue. Now, there's something inconceivable in this, because matter and spirit never really touch each other. So there's something quite inconceivable about the combination of matter and spirit. I'll read you a little bit here. This is this description by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur about how the Dharma and the mundane tract of land, they become connected with each other. The pure soul is eternally in the realm of the Supreme Lord, he says. The mundane tract of the countryside that is trod by every passerby must not be confounded, mistaken, with the highest sphere of the realm of the Absolute. Then he talks further about this and he says that the sadhu is in a position to employ the conditioned soul in the service of the realm of Braj by using this so-called mundane tract of land. He says, the land of Braj is specially privileged by being used by the sadhu for his purpose, which is to awaken the transcendental consciousness of the living entity who comes here. Mundane landscape is no doubt different from the spiritual realm, but the mundane in this case has a quasi-spiritual value. Do you know what quasi means?
Quasi is half.
Quasi, like half, yes. Spiritual, more or less spiritual value. The mundane in this case has a quasi-spiritual value as soon as it is used by the sadhu for kindling the spiritual consciousness of the dormant souls. So we're going to speak more about that particular point. But what suffice at this point to say that when Krishna appears here in this material world, the Dharma descends first to the particular place with the same name, same locality, and then Krishna's pastimes appear. And Krishna's pastimes in the material world, they go like the sun. We see the sun in the morning and it goes up and then it's sunset and it rises somewhere else. The sun never stops. It's just that when it's setting here, it's rising somewhere else. So Krishna's Prakat Leela, his manifest pastimes, they go from one universe to the next universe to the next universe to the next universe. And they're therefore, in that context, they're considered eternal. But they're eternal being performed on the physical sphere within the material energy. So they have some characteristics that are different than this transcendental Goloka Dham. So then the aprakat, this is the next aspect of the Dham. Prakat means when Krishna is present and his pastimes are taking place. Aprakat means when Krishna, two things. It means when Krishna leaves to go to Mathura and Dwarka and he's no longer visible to the residents of Vrindavan. And Srila Prabhupada asks and answers the question, does that mean that Krishna leaves Vrindavan? And he says, no, Krishna never leaves Vrindavan. And he explains that he resides here in his bhava expansion. His bhava expansion is not manifest. It's not visible to everyone. But to those who have pure love for him, they can perceive, just as we heard, by the television principle. This is also the place in which one experiences this samadhi that is being described by these great personalities who are viewers of this particular prakat lila. And the other name for the aprakat lila is the pastimes that take place in Goloka Dham, because those pastimes cannot be seen by any conditioned soul. No one can see them unless they're transcendentally purified. They cannot enter into that particular realm. And if somebody is interested in becoming transcendentally purified, they can come to this Vrindavan Dham, and from there they can become purified and elevated so that they can thereby enter into the Prakat Leela that is traveling, like Srila Prabhupada described, like a road show from one universe to another. When they're eligible, they go there. Then when they become further eligible, further purified, then they can go actually to this Goloka Vrindavan. And then when they reach that stage, they can go anywhere because they're completely free of matter. They can come here, they can go there, they can do as they wish, but they come and go in a completely transcendental body, not in a body made of matter in the way that we're familiar with. Now the third manifestation, the third aspect of the Dham is the one that we're looking at, and this is the one that's quasi-spiritual. Or as Srila Prabhupada sometimes uses the word, the Dham with a mayic covering. So someone was asking Srila Prabhupada why the Dham, it seems so dirty and the people are so rough and crude and there's so many strange things go on and so many anomalies are here. And Srila Prabhupada explained, you have to see beyond that. You have to develop the intelligence to go beyond that. Because this is Yoga Maya's trick. This is a covering which makes the materialist ineligible to go any further. They see this and they think, or they see this nowadays, they see this and they think, oh, this is a nice place to live. I can make myself a house here. I can live here quite comfortably. I can bring all the modern conveniences from the West. I can set them all up. I can have a wonderful time here. Either they think, no, I'm not attracted to this place, or they think, yes, I could come and live here. It's quite enjoyable to live in Vrindavan. You've got this very pleasant situation. I can use the material nature against herself, and I can make an air conditioner, and I can make a heater, and I can remove all of the inconveniences that nature provides here. I can make everything very convenient for myself, and I can live happily within the Dham. So what is this? Srila Jiva Goswami, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, is explaining. He asks a question whilst in Navadvip Dham on Parikram with Nityananda Prabhu. And he says, they're going around, Nityananda Prabhu is taking him from place to place. The third one, I'm sorry. The name for that is Drishyaman. Drishya means what you can see with your eyes, basically. This Maya covering, Drishyaman, the Dham when it's in this condition of Drishyaman. So then, Srila Jiva Goswami asks a question. He says, I see that there are many people living in Navadvipa. Now this applies also to Vrindavan. And they do not get Krishna bhakti. So how is it that offenses remain within them even though they're staying in Navadvip Dham, the place of purification? So here's a little bit of a speciality to Navadvip, but we can ask the same question in Vrindavan. How is it that people can live so many years in Vrindavan and actually not become, not attain to this Krishna prema that we're speaking about so ardently all the time? He says, Navadvip Dham is eternal, non-material, fully conscious and completely opposite to the material world. Likewise, Vrindavan. The houses, doors, rivers, streams, forests and courtyards in Navadvip are all composed of spirit and intensely attractive. It rests on Krishna's inconceivable and supremely magnanimous Sandini energy. By that energy, that Dham has descended here in Nadia to fulfill Lord Krishna's greatest desire to deliver the living entities. So how is it then that these people live, and they live in these transcendental places, but they become degraded? And we see this many times in Vrindavan, that people live here and become more degraded, more fallen than they would be if they lived in Delhi. If they lived in Delhi, they would just be an ordinary rascal, but they become a first-class, very deadly kind of, quite a sinister kind of a rascal, because they go around and they try to subvert people from the actual process, the pure path of religious devotion, surrender to Krishna. And you can see, Srila Prabhupada used to say that you would not see any Mayavadis in Vrindavan. Everyone is a Vaishnava. But there are sections of Vrindavan that are full of people who have, who are fully involved and fully adhere to the Mayavadi concept of life. So how are they all there? How are they not being affected by the transcendental spiritual atmosphere? So Nityananda Prabhu says, because there is no material thing or person can ever be situated in the Dham, a film of dull matter has been spread over the top of the Dham to keep it covered from the materialist. The people who have no relationship with Sri Krishna Chaitanya or Radha and Krishna simply live on top of that covering, blind to the real truth. Although one may think, I am living in Navadvip, Prouda Maya, who is no different than Yoga Maya, keeps the Dham far away from such a person. If by some great fortune one receives the association of a devotee, then he can develop a relationship with Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Then he can develop a relationship with the Dham. This topic of relationship is a very deep thing, not so easily understood by the conditioned soul. So I would like to say there that one reason why it's not easy for the conditioned soul to understand is that there is this deception at the base of his conception of life. And therefore, when you're talking to, if you ever had the experience of talking to a very deceptive person, it's very difficult to get through and to communicate to them because of the deceptivity in their way of approaching the exchange. So the living entity has this deceptiveness. He thinks, I am here to enjoy. I am enjoying. I am actually in control. At least I have my body and I have my family. And I have my work and the money I make from my work, and I can enjoy this luxury and this facility and so forth. I'm independent. So this deception makes it very difficult for somebody to understand the topic of relationship between the living entity and Krishna himself. Nityananda Prabhu says, the pretender, the deceitful, the arrogant, or a person who thinks himself highly qualified may call out the name of Chaitanya or Krishna with seeming affection. But if that relationship is not there, he simply remains in the material realm. Such a person resides on top of the illusory covering of the Dhamma and never attains pure bhakti. Then he goes on to explain that, but by the mercy of a devotee, if such a person begins to understand his actual position and starts to feel quite humble and starts to feel himself needy and fallen instead of overly confident in a foolish way, then he starts to be able to practice the chanting of Krishna's name in a way that it begins to produce this love of Krishna, which is the only qualification, premanjana churita bhakti vilochanena, to smear the eyes with this love or affection for Krishna, is the only way to actually see this transcendental aprakrit dham. Now, maybe I'll stop here for a moment and ask if anyone has any questions up to now, because we're covering so many things quickly. Yes. Third definition of aprakrit lila, unmanifest lila, is that the liberated soul, one who has this purity of heart and love of Krishna, he can tune in, so to speak, and he can actually experience Krishna's pastimes ever going on here, even at the present time. So this is what makes this mystery between this landscape, you could say, being quasi-spiritual. It's spiritual and it's not spiritual, depending on the qualification of the person involved. Did you want to say something?
I was just asking about that, because there's no difference between that
and here.
That
was my first understanding, but then I did read a quote that said the same thing. I don't know whether it means that somebody here, as you're saying, that from here somebody can be accessing the lila that takes place there, or whether, but there are quotes that indicate that the lila goes on here also.
But that here is there.
That here and there are non-different. Because when the Dhamma descends here to the material world, it's like a beam that comes down. But when that beam is within the phenomenal world, it has some characteristics that are distinct from the completely spiritual location. But it's only a question of location that's different. They're both non-different than each other. But they have some difference of characteristic in that the Prakrat Lila begins with the birth of Krishna. As we read in the Srimad Bhagavatam, he's born, he's a small baby, and then he grows, and then he goes to see Kilkamsa and so forth. This lila goes on here only on the material plane. And the lila that goes on in Goloka Vrindavan is Astakaliya lila. Asta means eight. And eight sections of the day, and transcendentally, pastimes take place day after day. So they're taking place on a day-to-day, transcendentally. In transcendental time, they take place in a different form. There's no birth pastime there. There's no killing of Kamsa there. There are no demons there. And here, these pastimes take place. And they take place in the sense that when the pastime takes place here, it takes place in the next universe, in the next universe. So they're continuously taking place. They're considered eternal in that sense, that pastime is constantly taking place. Does that... The practical way is through the ear, is to actually hear. This is the thing that struck me in this very higher level of explanation of Dham Tattva given by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, because he's speaking to people who are from the culture, so they already understand so many things, so then he's speaking further. But the most important point he points out is to hear, or to hear from the sadhu, particularly from the sadhu. Because when you hear through if you hear through the eyes of a person who's not blind, when you're blind, and the person who's not blind, you know the famous story of the blind man and the elephant. And one sighted man comes and says, oh no, an elephant isn't like a palm tree, because one blind man is feeling the leg. An elephant's not like a snake, because one blind man is feeling the tail. An elephant's not like a palm, not like something else, because they're all saying it's a little bit like this, a little bit like that. An elephant looks like this. Then they can describe what an elephant looks like. So, the first thing is to accept the fact that we're actually blind spiritually blind in that sense, and that we need to hear from those who can see. And these are the transcendental subject matter of the Bhagavatam, or of the various literatures that different personalities, Srila Rupa Goswami, our line, all the different acharyas have written, because they have the access through their transcendental television set, so to speak, is working. We have to, first of all, hear from them, even whilst with our eyes we're looking and seeing this thing and that thing, monkeys and this, so many different things, garbage. Pandas will go tomorrow and the pandas will harass us and ask us for money. And these things, they're kind of quaint to us because we see them culturally. We'll see so many things, and because we can be distracted by these things and kind of just immersed in all the social aspects. But if we want to actually penetrate, we have to become determined to hear. This is the key thing. So that's why Bhaktivinoda, in this article by Circumnambulating the Divine Realm of Braj, which seemed to me a very strong statement, which I started to think about and I understood that it's actually correct, he explains that the sadhu alone is in the position to employ the conditioned soul in the service of the realm of Braj, although the latter, the conditioned soul, is necessarily not fully aware of the same. The same means the service of the realm of Braj, until after he has been freed from all obscurity of vision. So one has to take the guide of an exalted personality. So we have to take as our primary point of reference Srila Prabhupada. And the more that we can have a sense of oneness with how Srila Prabhupada wanted us to behave within the Dham, and we can apply ourselves to that mood, the more quickly we'll be able to actually appreciate and enter into the transcendental subject matter that comes from so many sources. But if we don't have a primary point of reference, it's very dangerous, because people say different things. Even great liberated souls see differently. So if you just go shopping, so to speak, this one says this and that, so that's interesting, that's interesting, that's interesting, then you can become very confused. It becomes like a whirlwind. So we have to locate ourselves firmly. And then when we hear, we bring these subject matters that we hear to the reference point of what Srila Prabhupada has given us, and we'll see that it will illuminate what he's given. And we'll start to understand what's hidden within terms. Like when we say back to Godhead, we use this term all the time, we go back to Godhead. And people never think to open that term up, like it's like a little locked box. What does it mean? We say, oh, that person went back to God. If you die in Vrindavan, you go back to God. It becomes like heaven and hell. All the Christians will go to heaven. So we have to become actually thoughtful to expand that concept. And this is what I learned very much from Sachinandan Maharaj's meditations, and expanding what the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra has within it. So we're not just thinking this is some syllables we mechanically chant. I finished my 16 rounds, so I'm a devotee. But we understand that there's so much to be explored and experienced and developed from within this small mantra form. There's unlimitedness within that. Yes.